Have we already talked about 16? So I stopped on 15.
Last thing we talked
about was the Okasaki. Yeah, which was 15. 16 is really no new information. It's just a close-up of a replication bubble showing you that for each replication bubble, remember there's two replication forks, but in each replication bubble there are multiple strands or pieces of strands being built situated diagonally from each other. There's two categories of strands, leading strands and lagging strands. And so that's not, we've already talked about this. The lagging strands lag behind in time. They take longer to get built because they have to be built piecewise since they're being extended in the opposite direction compared to how the fork is opening. So number one here was the first one laid down when the fork was just opening right here. And then you had to wait until the fork opened it more to lay down a new primer and start another fragment and then grow it until you run into the previous fragment and so on. That's how in each of these Okazaki fragments can then be sewn together to make up the overall lagging strand. And we see it again with a little bit more detail in 17. So this really is a review as well. What's the pink thing up there? That's primase. It's laying down the primer. Then DNA polymerase 3, the orange enzyme, can build on that primer and extend it by adding DNA nucleotides one at a time. That's one Okazaki fragment. And that would, for instance, this one has already been built. You don't see all of it, but you see the primer. And then once the fork opens up a little more, primase comes along and adds another primer. DNA polymerase 3 extends it to the previous fragment, and so on. So you have a bunch of fragments. Then you need to get rid of the RNA in the primers and replace it with DNA. That's the job of the yellow one, which is DNA polymerase 1. But it can't make the final covalent bond between DNA nucleotides. So there, however many fragments there are, there's going to be a little nick that you need to sew together, and that's what the teal one does. That's ligase doing its job. Yeah. That's right. And the more the fork opens up, the more it allows for another fragment to be produced until you finally get to the next bubble. Yeah. Yes, it takes the DNA out, and it, by the way, it does not just switch the sugar. It doesn't change ribose into deoxyribose. It takes the entire RNA nucleotide out and then puts in a new DNA nucleotide, coming in as a DNA nucleoside triphosphate, because you still have to have the energy for DNA polymerase 1 to do that job. And when it gets to the when it butts up against the previous fragment, like right here, that is the 3' end of this section, right? And it can't make that 3' to 5' final covalent bond. That's what ligase does. Well, 18 is also really a summary. Now it just brings it all into one picture. And almost all of the players are here that we've talked about, the major proteins. Which one is missing? Topoisomerase. It's still doing its job, but it would be off to the left. And another one off to the right. This is really only half of a bubble, right, we're looking at. But in order, how things work is that an origin of replication, basically the middle of the bubble, is recognized on each strand by a helicase enzyme, which separates the two strands. So there's a helicase working here, the green one. It earlier recognized the origin of replication, separated the two, and then it starts unzipping this one to the left. Another helicase is going to be unzipping to the right on the other strand. its work would, the work of helicase would be done for nothing if it weren't for the fact that you then have these gray single-strand binding proteins come along and clamp to each strand and kind of follow helicase as it unzips. Those are necessary so that the two strands don't just go right back together, undoing what helicase did. This gives a chance for primase, the pink ones, there's one in shown here, to come along and lay down the first nucleotides, which, since they're the first nucleotides, have to be RNA. And that's why the primers are made out of RNA nucleotides. But primase does that job. And each leading strand requires only one primer because the fork is opening up in the correct direction for that growth. So only one primer is necessary. But for the lagging strand, there's going to have to be a primer for each Okazaki fragment. Primase does all that, though. And then DNA polymerase 3, the orange ones, come along and add DNA nucleotides one at a time to all of these, whether it's the leading strand or Okazaki fragments, until all the nucleotides are laid down. All the spaces are filled, in other words. We're not done, though, because we have two problems, right? We have RNA nucleotides making up these primers that can't be in the final product. Has to be purely DNA. So DNA polymerase 1 comes along, or copies of DNA polymerase 1 come along, and recognize the primers, remove the RNA nucleotides that make them up, replace them with the appropriate DNA nucleotides, and then finally DNA ligase comes along and sews all the bits together until you have continuous strands of new material, one for each of the two original strands. That is the completion, then, of DNA replication. So now the two original strands aren't ever going to come back together, right? Each one is half of a double-stranded DNA that is the final product, right? That's the essence of a semi-conservative model of replication. Each of the two copies is one old strand and one completely old strand and one completely new strand. Dark blue and light blue. All right, well, that's the basics of DNA replication, and that's how things normally proceed. And by normally, I mean if nothing goes wrong. And it's really impressive how infrequently things do go wrong, considering all that has to happen. If you compare this to industrial processes like in a factory or post office, things where the same thing is done over and over, you know, any business or anything like that, if you were to say that you have an error rate of only 1 per million, that would be impressive, right? There's a lot more mistakes that are made in factories than 1 per million when you do repetitive stuff. But one mistake in a million is actually way more than you can tolerate when it comes to copying DNA. Because just one chromosome, and there are several chromosomes in each cell, but one chromosome is millions of nucleotides long. So even if you made only one mistake per million, you would always be making many mistakes for each chromosome every cell cycle. So mistakes do happen, but they are pretty impressively low to begin with. It's made even lower, though, because cells have evolved mechanisms collectively called the proofreading mechanism that allows recognition of those errors after they've been made and then correcting them so that they don't persist. And the errors can be simply because the wrong nucleotide was put down to begin with during replication. That's just one example of an error. Or also, the replication can go off without a hitch, and changes can be made to DNA for other reasons. Mutations happen, for instance. So proofreading mechanisms allow the cell to recognize something has gone wrong and a lot of the times those errors can be fixed. So the actual error rate is truly impressively low. Here we have just one example of something going wrong. In the top double-stranded DNA, notice that the top strand of this has two nitrogenous bases, which are the things, remember, nitrogenous bases are just hanging off of the sugar phosphate backbone. They're not hooked to each other. They don't hold the strand together. So they're not supposed to be bonded to each other. But these two are. And this happens pretty often, or pretty easily, if two nitrogenous bases next to each other on the same strand are thymine. Because the sequence, remember, can be anything. Sequence has, within one strand, that has nothing to do with complementarity. It can be three A's in a row, whatever. So you often have two T's next to each other. Two thymines are particularly prone to forming a covalent bond between them, which is called a thymine-thymine dimer. D-I-M-E-R is just a two-part thing, like monomer is one part and polymer is many parts. This happens pretty easily in response to exposure to ultraviolet radiation from sunlight. It's one reason why sunlight causes cancer. But it's a defect, right? It's not going to allow the DNA to work correctly if the thymine-thymine dimer is allowed to persist. So part of the proofreading mechanism involves what is called excision repair. Excise is the verb of form of excision. The CIS part, just like in scissors, means cut. So X means out. So excision means to cut out. Excision repair involves specialized enzymes. This is really a family of enzymes. It's not a single one. But they're called nucleases. Nucleases are enzymes that are able to cut bonds between nucleotides in a strand. In other words, to cut a strand into pieces. And nucleases recognize, for instance, this thymine-thymine dimer. That's part of the proofreading mechanism. And they make two cuts, one on either side of the problematic stretch. And though all of the DNA nucleotides between those two cuts get removed. Now, why is this not problematic? Why does the cell not have to worry that these DNA nucleotides are being removed? Because remember, DNA nucleotides are part of the information. Right, it's able to replace them perfectly because it still has the other strand to read to know what to replace them with. And that's exactly what happens, but its nuclease does only the cutting out and removal. It requires then DNA polymerase 1 to come along and fill in the hole with brand new nucleotides. And just like when we were talking about in DNA replication, DNA polymerase 1, after it adds that last nucleotide, cannot sew it together with its neighbor. So you still, once again, have to have DNA ligase come along and make that final covalent bond. But once that's complete, if it's able to do this, this repaired DNA is completely normal. It's impossible to tell that anything ever went wrong, right? Because you're replacing with exactly the same stuff. Okay, now to 20. Yeah, go ahead.
So, question. So for CR, I know it has the polymerase in it. Does it also have the nuclease? Does it replicate? There could be errors.
It doesn't have error checking, but it not only has polymerase, which is what it's named for. It also has pre-made primers. So instead of recognizing where primers need to be, we have primers in the mix that will bind just to the complementary sequence in the DNA sample. In other words, we don't copy the entire DNA sample. I didn't mention this in lab. We copy just part of it, starting at a place that is complementary to a primer that we intentionally put into the mix.
So it doesn't really have errors because it's like a specific one?
I'm not saying it's not impossible for there to be errors. It's just that it's when you do 40 replications, 40 cycles, you make so many millions of copies that if there's one or two that are erroneous, you won't even notice it. Now, this slide, 20, illustrates a problem that exists only for eukaryotic cells, which is what we've been mostly talking about. But, of course, prokaryotic cells undergo DNA replication as well. They don't have this problem, though, and that's because of this fundamental difference in the shape of chromosomes when you compare prokaryotic cells and eukaryotic cells. Prokaryotic cells have chromosomes that are circular. There are no ends. And this problem that I'm about to tell you about occurs only if you have ends. Prokaryotic cells don't have ends on their chromosomes. So this applies only to eukaryotes. Now, remember when we first looked at replicated chromosomes consisting of two sister chromatids, I used the word centromere, which was the place where they're joined together. Well, there's another word similar to that called telomere. And telo, just like in telophase or telescope, means far or the extent. A telomere is the end of a linear chromosome. And of course, this applies only to eukaryotic chromosomes. They're the only ones that have ends. The reason this is a problem that we're looking at here has to do with what I've already told you about the inability to lay down DNA onto nothing. You can only lay down DNA nucleotides onto a strand that already is partially built, like a primer, right? That's why you have to start with RNA as the primers and then add DNA to that. Well, here we have a couple fragments, these two red primers and the light blue DNA that's already been added. But this is the very end of the chromosome. This is the end of the DNA. At the other end, you would have the same problem only on the bottom strand. I mean, the same situation. Anyway, everything's fine up to this point, except the process is not complete, right? Because we still have RNA to get rid of, and that, as we've said, requires DNA polymerase 1 to come along. Well, it will come along and successfully remove the RNA, and its other job, of course, is to replace the missing RNA, the now missing RNA, with DNA, right? Let's consider this one, not the one on the end, but a little bit in, the right red primer. When DNA polymerase 1 comes along and removes these, it will have no problem replacing them with DNA because this light blue stretch to the left already exists there, right? And when you make this hole, you can add to this, because this is the 3' end, and fill in the gap. No problem. That's what happens for the vast majority of the primers. But on this one that's at the very end, it can remove those, but there's no existing DNA that it can add on to, so it can't replace them with DNA. It has to just leave a hole. And this occurs only at the two ends, and only for eukaryotic chromosomes. What this means is that even if no mistakes are made, DNA replication in eukaryotes results in a slightly shorter chromosome because it can't go all the way to the end. It's going to leave these holes.
So that would be almost attributed to like aging?
This is implicated in maybe one of the reasons why we age, yes. But And related to that is what this means is that there would be a maximum number of times this could happen successfully, right, without dying, because you're getting a shorter and shorter DNA each cell cycle. Well, It might. This wouldn't necessarily be a problem for a couple times, or for some limited number of times, because of something that might surprise you about DNA. We haven't talked much about genes yet, but we will in the next unit, and or in the next chapter. Genes are just subsequences of the overall sequence that the DNA is. DNA is one long sequence, but there are subsequences that you can think of making up that sequence. And a gene is just a subsequence that tells the cell how to build an RNA molecule. And then there's another gene somewhere, and there's stretches of DNA which are still nucleotides, but they are not so-called non-coding regions because they're just between the genes. And what might surprise you is that the genes themselves, when you add up all that DNA material, is less than 1% of your overall DNA. Most of it is non-coding regions between genes, including non-coding regions at the ends. So what I'm saying here is that since the genes aren't all the way at the ends, it doesn't really matter so much if you can't fill in this hole and it gets a little bit shorter, as long as there's a limit to it, right? I usually use an analogy with motion picture film, although now it's all digital. But you're familiar with motion picture film, right? If you project a film through film using a projector, you have to spool that film through the projector. And the entire reel of film is like one DNA, one chromosome. And the individual frames of the movie are kind of like genes. But the first gene doesn't occur all the way at the end or the beginning of the reel, right? You have to have a leader, as it's called, a length of film that allows you to put it into the machine, take it up on the take-up spool so that the first frame of the movie comes later. And that leader gets abuse by sticking it into the machine. If it's a really popular film, it gets shown a lot of times. You have to do this over and over, and it gets frayed. The leader gets frayed. So the solution to that is just cut a little piece of it off to give you a nice fresh edge. That's not a problem as long as you do it only so many times. But if you kept doing that, you would eventually be cutting frames of the movie out that you would never see again, right? That would be like this happening to a gene, which would eventually happen if there were no way around this problem. That would mean eukaryotic organisms could not eventually continue to live. They would all go extinct because of this. So that obviously doesn't happen because we're here. And that's because eukaryotic organisms have evolved a mechanism to solve this problem, which is that they have specialized enzymes called telomerases, obviously named for the telomeres. A telomerase enzyme, after this, what's shown here happens, comes along and just adds a length of fresh leader, basically, that is just a non-coding stretch of DNA nucleotides that gets added to the end simply so that it can be eroded away next time without doing any damage. And therefore, over the cell cycles, over the generations of cells, it doesn't really cause a problem. It doesn't eat into any genes. The remaining two slides, 21 and 22, are in the book this came from, combined into one picture. You can see 22 is the right half of it, 21 is the left half. And what this shows is the organization of chromatin. Remember that chromatin is a combination of one tremendously long DNA double helix plus a bunch of proteins. And the reason that chromatin is necessary is to package this enormously long DNA into tiny spaces. Last week you did a calculation, right, about how much the combined length of DNA in one human individual is. Well, it's over 1,000 times, just one individual, over 1,000 times the distance from the Earth to the Sun, which is impressive. And over a meter, you know, close, almost 2 meters, just in one cell. Well, the reason this is able to happen is because DNA is not the only thing in there. It would just be a tangled mess. DNA is packaged with proteins, and these proteins specifically are histones, and you can see histones. Before we get to that, though, let me say that as you go from left to right on this overall two-slide picture, you're zooming out. So we're really close up here. All we see is the DNA. And then we're taking the camera out, getting a wider view of things. But each histone resembles more or less a human sperm. It has a globular head and then a tail. That's just one histone by itself. If you complex 8 histones, which are identical to each other, in this way, so that their tails radiate out, and it's a pair of 4 to make 8 overall, you form what more or less is a hose reel or a spool. And therefore, part of the enormous length of this DNA can be taken up by wrapping that part around one spool. And that's done over and over. Each one of these spools, which are the 8 histones plus the DNA that's wound around it, is called a nucleosome. And in a real... this is a cartoon, of course, but in a real photograph like up here, you can see individual nucleosomes that look like beads on a string. And the string in between each nucleosome is simply DNA, still part of the overall DNA, but it's not wound around anything. It's between spools. So just this by itself, this winding around the spools, drastically decreases the overall length that you have to deal with. But as we continue to zoom out, notice that the nucleosomes are then huddled together to form this collection that makes it a much thicker, wider fiber, but a lot less long, a lot shorter. And then, as we continue to zoom out in 22, we can see that this already compact fiber gets looped back and forth thousands of times to form an even wider and shorter structure, and that's what makes up the overall condensed chromatid that we see as a chromosome and officially name it a chromosome. That, I believe, is the end of the chapter. Yes.